the Republicans to wake up is... What the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. You're about to hear an important conversation with Peter Van Buren. He worked in the State Department. He wrote a book about his experiences spending a year in Iraq squandering American dollars on Reconstruction called We Meant Well. And today he joins us for a thorough analysis of America's new war in Iraq and Syria. And late in the conversation, he reaches a conclusion that there is no point to this effort. I think you'll find it fascinating and informative. Before we begin, I want to thank the people who subscribe to my podcast and support this work. People like Del Leonard, a longtime supporter and subscriber. Also, Joe Davis and Paul L. Sesser. I can rely on them every month. I'd appreciate your support, too. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. Under my picture on the homepage, there's a link that says Sign Up. You click there and it takes you to a page where you choose $5, $10, $20 a month or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. And if you're a new annual subscriber in the U.S. and you act quickly, I have one or two copies of Peter Van Buren's novel that was published earlier this year called The Ghosts of Tom Joad, and I will offer that as a bonus gift to two new annual subscribers if you act very quickly. Returning to our program today, Peter Van Buren. He served 20 years plus at the United States State Department, published the book We Meant Well, based on his experiences working in the so-called Reconstruction of Iraq, and he is now independent, having cut loose from the State Department after a bit of a struggle. And earlier this year, he published a great novel about the 99% called The Ghosts of Tom Joad. Outspoken, we hope so. Peter Van Buren, welcome back to our program.
Peter, always a pleasure to be here on the show with you.
Well, it's good to talk with you, and I wanted to draw on your expertise as a veteran of our diplomatic corps and as someone who's actually been to Iraq, unlike me, and many of our listeners who only have received information about the situation there, both in the past and currently. And you have been speaking up in recent weeks about our new incursion into Iraq with the added bonus gift of airstrikes in Syria. And it's a complicated picture, there's no doubt about it. But you managed to cut through a lot of the smoke and the spin and really talk honestly about the ludicrous nature of expecting that essentially by remote control that we can have the desired impact on the ground in Syria and Iraq and roll back this monster that we created called the Islamic State. Give me your opening thoughts about the situation as it stands today and the steps that President Obama has taken to launch this new open-ended war in the Middle East.
You know, 4 years after I left Iraq, if you had asked me when I left Iraq in 2010, if 4 years later we would still be talking about American war making in the country, I really would have looked at you as a little bit crazy. 2010, things were winding down. The last combat troops were packing up their gear. And less than a year later, we were done. The last American military did, in fact, leave. The whole campaign there was supposed to be turned over to the State Department. And the president himself, Obama, told us at a speech to his military admirers that we had left Iraq a democratic, stable country that was on its way to becoming an ally of the United States, and that was supposed to be that. Moving on to Afghanistan or whatever was teed up next. You have to just shake your head and wonder, how did we get from there to here? It was almost like watching a magician do a trick. You know there was something that had to happen, because eggs really don't come out of people's ears. And you know there was some sleight of hand, and it had to have happened right in front of you, but you still can't really see what was done. And that's largely how I'm perceiving Iraq right now. I don't quite understand how we suddenly are at war there, and then again in Syria.
Mm-hmm. And Peter, one of the fundamentals that, in my view, is driving this was the notion that our surge was successful. The surge of additional troops and the payments to the so-called Sunni moderates, the Sunni awakening. And you were directly involved with some of those Sunni leaders. And I don't know the complete dimension, but at least some of those people are now high-ranking officials in the Islamic State, if not people that have their support and sympathy. Can you give us a little sense of how the Sunni awakening morphed into what is today called the Islamic State?
There's a lot of very complicated things in Iraq, and this is, if you needed a quick reason why we should not be involved there, it's because it becomes very difficult to understand very quickly. Alliances are fluid. Friends today can be enemies tomorrow, and then friends again soon after that. And America's sort of global belief system that there are good guys, white pieces on the board and black pieces on the board, and that we make alliances as if this was still the 19th century and, you know, the British sign a treaty with us or something, underlies many of the failures in the Middle East and are predictors of the failures of the future. But let's go back in time a little bit to 2007. At around that time in Iraq, the insurgency / civil war between Sunni and Shia was at its peak. People were literally dying in the streets, car bombs and whatever, and the violence was doing nothing but ramping up. The United States was desperate for some type of solution, particularly one that would allow us to find our way towards the exits and get out of Iraq with a little bit of victory to claim. And there evolved out of this a strategy called the Anbar Awakening, or the Sons of Iraq. It all kind of goes by the different names. But essentially, it worked out this way. We were going to try to split the indigenous Sunni population of Iraq, the people who live there, off from foreign fighters like Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda could only survive in Iraq, and ISIS was at that time part of Al-Qaeda. They're one in the same beast then and to a certain extent now, but certainly then. We were going to split the indigenous population off from these foreign fighters, these outside groups. And the idea would be that Al-Qaeda could never survive without the support of the Sunni population on the ground. At the same time, we were going to clean up the Uber problem of Iraq, which was a government that was dominated by the Shias, thanks to our invasion, and which had marginalized, if not persecuted, if not murdered, large numbers of Sunnis. It was going to be the quick fix to the whole war.
And those who weren't marginalized and persecuted or killed were sometimes locked up in American-controlled prisons and further radicalized.
Which was the gift that we gave al-Baghdadi, the titular head of ISIS. He mm-hmm. spent some time in one of our gulags over there and had a chance to make lots of friends with other Sunnis radicals and to become more radicalized politically himself. And so I'm sure the Baghdadi clan thanks the United States for those opportunities. But back to the surge and the awakening and things, and it's important to understand it because it's the same strategy that we're relying on today. So anyway, the idea was how to get the Sunnis to act against their own interests. They had allied with al-Qaeda simply because they needed muscle. They needed someone to help protect them from the Shias. The Shia government was supported by the United States, armed by the United States, advised by the United States, and had a distinct advantage over the Sunnis. And they needed someone to help them, and al-Qaeda came along and said, we can do that for you, much the same way that ISIS is doing it today. Okay. So what the United States did is they said to the Sunnis, we will pay you a lot of money to stop killing us, the Americans. We will also, if you rat out some al-Qaeda people, we will kill them for you. And parenthetically, if there's a guy that you don't really like, we'll whack him for you too. No, just point at it and say it's al-Qaeda. And number three, while all this is going on, we will pressure the Shia government to take you in, to give your people jobs, to give you a role in the security forces so they don't persecute you anymore, and to give you Sunni people positions of power in the government. So the United States began airdropping money into the hands of these Sunnis, and initially there was actually some progress, at least as far as getting rid of al-Qaeda. The Sunnis took the deal, trusted the United States, vaguely trusted that the United States could pressure the Shia government, and the deal went off. The problem is that as soon as the United States started transitioning, and that's air quotes all over the place on that word, transitioning the program to the Shia government, the Shias reneged on all the deals. America at that point was preoccupied with getting out of Iraq and paid no attention to it. That was my tiny little part of all this, in that I was sent out often to meet with Sunni warlords in the area around where I was assigned in Iraq, and basically to beg them, A, not to kill me, and B, to kind of stick with the plan a little bit longer, even though it obviously wasn't working and the Shia government was obviously walking away from it. I was basically there to tell the landlord, I'm going to pay you next week. Just give me one more week on the rent, please, in hopes that a week later I could get another week out of him. It didn't work. And after the United States left, the Shia government turned full force, including the defense ministry and the interior ministry controlled the police, and the Sunnis got the fuzzy end of the lollipop on that.
Mm-hmm.
Fast forward to today. The United States has exactly the same plan underway. Instead of al-Qaeda proper, it's now trying to pry the Sunnis away from ISIS. And the same promises are being made. We're going to give you money. We're going to whack ISIS for you. We're going to convince the Shia government, with a new prime minister installed by the United States, we're going to convince them to bring you into the fold and give you this deal. You're going to be part all the things we promised you in 2007, you're now going to get in 2014. And hey, trust us, we're from the government. That is why the Sons of Iraq failure in 2007 is so critical to understanding the upcoming failure of America's Iraq adventure in 2014, or perhaps drag on into next year.
Mm-hmm.
The bad news, in case listeners are on the edge or on the ledge right now and trying to decide whether to jump or stay for the second half of the program, is that basically it's the same people who failed in 2007 who are now in charge of this again. America's point man in Iraq today is General Allen, who in fact actually retired from the military after serving with the Marine Corps in Anbar and has been brought out of retirement so that he can run the exact same program that he ran in 2007 when it failed.
Mm-hmm.
On the State Department, the civilian side, the State Department side, the main character is a guy named Brett McGurk, who was senior advisor to the embassy over seven ambassadors right through the Bush and the Obama administrations, and so had a hand in absolutely everything that went wrong. And he's in charge still. He's now been promoted to the Assistant Secretary for Iraq and Iran Affairs, the senior State Department position on those issues, and he's back in charge, and lot of the minor characters as well.
And forgive me, but you tag Brett McGurk as the Malachi Whisperer. explain that, because Malachi hung on for a long time after it was clear that Obama had personally soured on him. And I know we have some, you know, modest observance of the parliamentary system and the phony democracy that we created there in Baghdad. But Malachi lingered for a long time. Was McGurk his enabler?
The Malachi Whisperer title I can't claim as an original. It was actually assigned to McGurk by people in the U.S. Embassy during the high days there as a compliment that he was so close to former Prime Minister Malachi and was able to influence him so effectively that they called him the Malachi Whisperer. I believe it's become ironic at this point in time. Mm-hmm. You know, America treats leadership in Iraq like a fantasy football team. You know, if you don't like who you've got, you trade and swap for some other ones. If this week doesn't go so well, hey, you win some, you lose some, but you get some new players next week and try to do better. And that's what's happening. Prime Minister Malachi did hang on long after his effective date. But keep in mind that the United States put him in power in 2006 and essentially stood by while the Iranians reinstalled him into power in the failed 2010 elections and then supported him from there forward. And so suddenly to decide in the last couple of months that, hey, Malachi is no longer our man, and to scrape up a new guy, it really is completely disrespectful to the concept of democracy, never mind parliamentary rule, never mind what we really think of it.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that's important to remember about Malachi's successor, Mr. Abadi, is that he is a Shia. He comes from Malachi's own party. He was a close associate of Malachi, and he has strong ties to Iran, as do all the senior Shia leaders in Iraq. And so while he's being pushed out through the American media as, you know, the savior, the new guy, the reformer, what have you, in fact, he's just basically the old model with a new coat of paint.
Mm-hmm. And he's given the task of being a uniter, not a divider. But there really isn't anything left to unite. And I'd like to ask you to address twin fictions that I consider to be similar in both the notional idea they advance and the vacuousness of the idea. And that is that the Congress, which can't agree on anything, found $500 million to put on the line for so-called moderates in Syria. And Carl Levin, the senator from Michigan, has been talking about these moderates, vetted moderates, for a long time, and it's pretty clear that they never existed and aren't about to appear. And likewise, and I put this to you as a question because you know more than I do, but are there any moderate Sunni leaders left in Iraq that Abadi could actually form a government with and successfully confront the Sunni extremists who, you know, control expanding territory in their country?
Well, the moderates both in Iraq and Syria are basically unicorns, often spoken of but never really seen.
Hmm.
One of the huge mistakes of a very long list that was made during the occupation was when the United States couldn't find powerful Sunni leaders who would stick to our script and fit our image of what they were supposed to be. We simply went to the B team or the C team and anointed them as the people we were going to work with, as if that alone was going to change them from minor thugs into significant warlords. I am sure somewhere out there in Iraq there are reasonable people. We'll have to stop for a second, though, and figure out what this word moderate really means, because I haven't seen anyone actually define it. John McCain talks about the moderates as if they're people who live down the hall from him, but no one's ever actually defined it. It seems to be something like, you know, you're willing to fight against the people we're currently angry at and not fight against the people we're currently in favor of, and that you're not really too Muslim. You know what I'm saying? You know, you kind of not too gritty.
Yeah.
And you know, so that's the question, of course, is what are moderates? But the idea would be that I'm sure there are reasonable people in Iraq. The problem, of course, is what to do with them and how not to... Well, first of all, can they actually exert power? Because a lot of very unreasonable people have access to militias and government forces and all sorts of arms and armed men and women. So that's a question there. Second, how tainted will these people become simply because they are being helped by the United States?
Right.
This has always been a conundrum in the Middle East, is that every time we find a group to support, we basically turn them into stooges, either in reality in most cases, or certainly in the eyes of their own people. Every time the United States finds some freedom-loving group in Iran to support, they lose all their support because nobody wants to be associated with an American entity. So I don't know if there are any moderates, but I do know that it seems wicked hard to imagine that they'll ever come to positions of power or authority.
Mm-hmm. And likewise, in Syria, the idea that in this 3.5-year civil war, where there have been so many different foreign fighters, including those who now call themselves IS, who we supported when their focus was solely on bringing down the Assad government, and we weren't concerned about beheadings or any brutality that was used in pursuit of that goal. But once they stopped listening to their so-called masters and, you know, took on their own set of missions, they suddenly become this monster that we must decapitate. And the idea that $500 million put into arms and other supplies for a group that will take on the brutal forces of the dictator and the brutal foreign fighters who have been taking him on over the last 3.5 years strikes me as is not even worthy of a Hollywood script.
Well, this is why I think I've lost my sense of humor over all these things. We've had a lot of fun on your show talking about the absurdities of the American occupation in Iraq and oftentimes American foreign policy in general. But when the reality becomes absurd enough, you can't find a way to make jokes about it. It's almost impossible to believe. Can you imagine the ISIS people, or whatever you want to call it? We'll use that as a handy term here, but I think we know and your listeners know that there's no such thing as ISIS as a monolithic structure, you know, like Walmart. It's a bunch of groups that have alliances with each other, that have loosely formed common goals and all that other stuff. But we'll say ISIS for convenience. But can you imagine the ISIS people sitting around one day and then they notice on Twitter that the Obama administration has reversed itself 180 degrees from supporting ISIS to bomb Assad to titularly supporting Assad to bomb ISIS? Can you imagine them trying to figure that out? They must have been flipping through their dictionaries to make sure they understood it properly.
Mm-hmm.
I guess America's English-speaking allies also had the same reaction. You know, but the idea here is that it doesn't make any sense. It can't possibly work. You've got these groups that were supposedly these moderates that we're looking for that, if in fact they were armed, would love to get rid of Assad, who they see as a much more dangerous entity than ISIS. But America is in this position where we've got to sort of convince them to leave Assad alone for a while. Go after ISIS, who sort of was on their side for a while. Get rid of ISIS, like that's a check mark on a to-do list. And then, you know, if America's still vaguely interested in this in a couple of years, then you can turn on Assad, assuming he hasn't chemically wiped you out or shot you down or whatever else is going on. It can't work. There's nothing about it that has the vaguest possibility of working. Mm-hmm. And for everyone says, well, you know, you never know. I mean, that's sort of the concept of like gravity. I mean, you jump out the window And in theory, I guess you could say you never know. You might go up rather than down. But gosh, reality and the smart money is that gravity is going to win again. And the same thing in the Middle East, that these American plans are based on air and fantasy and really have no chance of succeeding.
And Peter, just to extend that further into the absurd, let's just stipulate that with airstrikes alone, we are able to decimate IS, ISIL, whatever we're going to call them.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we are committed to taking out the Assad government. But there is no even hint of what would follow that. Do we, you know, we're 0 for 4 on the puppet regimes, and we're going to add another one? I mean, do we get Israel to select the next leader of Syria? After all, it's a neighbor, and they've got a lot at stake there. But, you know, we failed in Egypt, in Libya, in Iraq, and Afghanistan. And the idea that even if you put the U.S. in a leading from the rear perspective, the idea that the West can dictate who the next leader of Syria will be after we've permitted the country to be decimated, and by the way, I didn't support intervention before, and I don't support it now, but the world has watched as Syria has simply imploded. And the idea that, 5 years from now, after more carpet bombing and more infiltration of foreign fighters, that this can be some sort of a governable state that would not be hostile to Western interests, I think that's even more bizarre than what we're doing right now.
And you've hit the nail on the head, though. I have to throw in the point about 0 for 4 sounds like my fantasy football team, since we'd used that analogy a little earlier here, and I needed to tie that all together for your listeners. But, of course, and the thing that makes it even worse is that we've been here before, as you said. I mean, if you want to know what the future of Syria is going to look like, we'll just take a look at Libya.
Mm-hmm.
Thing that makes Syria far, far more dangerous, the chaos that is inevitable in Syria, far, far more dangerous are a couple of things. First, there are still some pretty significant weapons locked up someplace, chemical weapons, perhaps biological weapons, certainly serious hardware. Russians supplied surface-to-surface missiles, go figure, whatever else is in Assad's lockers right now. And whenever things fall apart completely in Syria, and of course they will, that's almost a goal of the United States, all those weapons are going to start to spread out into the greater Middle East, as Gaddafi's weapons have found their way out of Libya all over the place. That's one huge difference in why Syria would be worse. I think the other thing, though, is your allusion to the Israelis. Syria is in a very different neighborhood. Libya's neighbors are mostly either not very interested in Libya and Libyan territory, or disorganized themselves, or prone to chaos even without too much pushing and shoving into the pit. Well, Syria is in a very different neighborhood, especially vis-a-vis the Israelis. Now, the Israelis are always the wild card in the Middle East, and we can only imagine what kind of sleazy deal-making is going on behind the scenes by the United States to get the Israelis to stay out of all this. The Israelis certainly have shown an interest in making sure their needs are covered. They shot down a Syrian government airplane over the Golan Heights, largely, I'm sure, as a warning more than any kind of military necessity. And they are keeping a very close eye on what happens on the other side of those mountains in Syria. The UN peacekeepers who had been assigned there have left for their own safety. There had been some kidnappings, and some form of insurgent out of Syria had been threatening to overrun them. Imagine chaos in Syria reaching the point where the Israelis feel a need to either attack defensively to keep the bad guys on their side of the border, or perhaps offensively to seize some territory, realign some borders, or to go in and button up some of those weapons we talked about. At that point, when you've got the Israelis fighting, it's World War II and a half, if not worse, And all of it is directly traceable back to America's actions, pulling the bottle stopper and letting the genie out of the bottle.
And Peter, your reference to a world war, I do not think is in any way far-fetched. I think we have been fortunate to date that this has remained a regional conflict. But with the intervention of the U.S. and with the selective intervention by allies like Britain, and now we have Australia running bombing raids in this area, the risk of it expanding and for China and Russia to come off the sidelines, I think, is very significant.
Absolutely. And let's look at some of the differences between either 1991, you know, the Iraq War, the first Iraq War, or 2003, the second, and today's Iraq War tray. You know, back in both of those first wars on the Israeli side, U.S.-Israeli relations were a lot closer. And the U.S., I think, was in a much better position to diplomatically influence slash pressure Israel. I think U.S.-Israeli relations have drifted since then, and the U.S. is in a much weaker position. I think the Israelis have also recently made some internal decisions to not really goof around. Their incursion into Gaza this time was no mere swatting. It was open warfare where the intent was to destroy cities and eliminate infrastructure, and without much concern about women and children and innocents being killed. So the Israelis are not the people, not the country they were in 2003 or 1991, where the U.S. could keep them out. Both the first, second Gulf War, there was a very weak Soviet Union, or Russia, sorry, who hadn't shown a whole lot of interest in expansion or poking around in some areas of the world that they weren't particularly immediately interested in. Well, now you've got a new Russia there, who clearly has some expansionist ideas, who clearly has a leader with no love for the United States, who wouldn't mind throwing a little sand in Obama's face. You've also got other factors. You've got Iran and Saudi Arabia and maybe some others in the area who are much, much further along as nuclear threshold states. Many of these places have no interest in challenging the accepted world order by actually going nuclear today, but many of them are in a position where they could very rapidly transition into nuclear states if they felt threatened or if they felt the need to do so. And that's three big differences that could easily pull this thing in the Middle East out of a regional conflict and into a very significant international one, and even with some possibility of nuclear action, though I'll stress that that's probably on the edge of possibilities, but still there.
Peter, one of the consistent pledges from President Obama is that he is opposed to putting U.S. troops back on the ground in Iraq, and has been fairly consistent in opposing even the idea of U.S. troops in Syria. Yet, over the weekend, McClatchy News is reporting that helicopter gunships operated by U.S. Troops are active in Erbil now. And to me, it's simply a matter of time before IS successfully shoots down one of our drones or fighters or helicopters and creates the pretext or the casus belli, as we often refer to it, for expansion and for the insertion of significant numbers of American troops. I feel like the president is simply trying to hold on until the November election, similar to his strategy on presidential authority related to immigration policy, and that once he is a pure lame duck, there will really be nothing holding him back. The Congress surely has signaled. John Boehner has said that he will not even bring up a war resolution, whether it were passed or not, during the lame duck session. So the president will have a free hand, and I believe he's likely to use it.
I agree completely. What else do you want to talk about for the rest of the time here?
Okay.
No,
I've got a lot more to talk about, but go ahead.
Of course, I have to throw in on this. I absolutely do agree with everything you said and the way you've put it. I think a lot of this boots on the ground thing, and Lord, too, I hate that expression.
Yeah.
It's something so worn out. But I think a lot of this is already in the realm of semantics. You know, special forces poking around aren't boots on the ground. And boots on the ground means combat troops, which is hard to define. And American staff and logisticians on the ground aren't boots on the ground. And helicopter pilots flying, you know, 20 feet off the ground aren't boots on the ground, and so forth.
And we have 2,100 Marines who have just been deployed to Kuwait in a crisis response force, and that's boots on ground. It's really hard to say that that's not the case.
Funny you should mention those Marines, because they are there for basically one purpose, and that is to prevent Benghazi 2. They are there to be flown in to the American embassy in Baghdad to make sure that it does not fail. By fail, I mean fall.
Mm-hmm.
That it can be held if at all possible, and if it can't be held, that it can be safely evacuated. That's what I think those Marines are really there for, and that's a role that Marines traditionally play, and a lot of the Marines that are already in Iraq are assigned to the embassy proper. And that's an indication, by the way, of what people are worried about in Washington, is what happens to that embassy and the symbolism that it has. I agree with you that as a lame duck, Obama is going to be free to do an awful lot of things. As you pointed out, he's put immigration on hold. Hey, that Senate torture report that was supposed to be out, mm-hmm. I suspect we're not going to see that before the election, and a lot of other issues. It's very easy, given the way this has evolved. I talked earlier in the show about magician sleight of hand, where you saw the trick, you knew he had to have done something, but you can't quite figure it out. I mean, just take a look at the last 8 weeks or so. We started out with the humanitarian mission to save the Yazidis in Iraq. This was going to be a very limited thing, you know, some humanitarian aid. And that transitioned into we need to protect Americans in Iraq who we put there. Then that quickly transitioned into we had to save the Kurds. And all of a sudden, now we're at war in Syria and we're bombing all over Iraq. And as you pointed out, we've now gone from jets that fly above any weapons that we think ISIS has to helicopters that are vulnerable to even small arms fire. And we saw helicopters go down even in Iraq War II from small arms fire. No matter how heavily they're armored, the blades can go down, the cockpit can be pierced, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of ways mechanical errors can happen. So the fact that we've slid down this slippery slope so quickly already, and the fact that the term boots on the ground has become semantically so flexible, I think it's difficult to imagine the president not being tempted to do it. And if he doesn't do it, it's hard to imagine the next president who's going to walk into office with this problem on his or her desk not being tempted to say, well, we can fix this with American troops.
Mm-hmm.
It won't work. We had 160,000 American troops in Iraq by the time the war ended, and they couldn't fix it. It's unclear how a smaller number or even a larger number would succeed.
Peter, I appreciate what you just said in recounting the shifting narrative and the shifting rationale for our re-engagement in Iraq. But as an acclaimed fiction writer now, I wanted to ask your sense of the insertion of the new character called Khorasan in this shifting narrative. I was traveling in Asia and had, you know, spotty access to the news. And when I first heard about Khorasan, it's like, what? I mean, I pay attention and I try to follow these things. And I actually had heard of the Yazidis before they climbed up on that barren mountain and asked to be rescued. But Khorasan seems to be a complete Hollywood screenwriter concoction.
Wag the Dog is, I think, the touch point in Hollywood media. Mm-hmm. For listeners who haven't seen that film, it's probably required viewing at this point in time. It stars Dustin Hoffman and Robert De Niro, and is just a terrific example of how Americans can be manipulated by the media into supporting wars. Khorasan is, in fact, a construct. It may or may not even exist as an independent organization. If it does, it's some kind of al-Qaeda offshoot hybrid thing. And the United States never heard of it. In fact, it needed to be created in order for us to hear about it, and became another excuse for the bombing and the missile attacks on Syria. It served its real purpose, and so now we don't learn much about it, though it's important to stress that James Comey was in the media recently announcing that even though the United States launched cruise missiles at whatever Khorasan is, you never know, they could still be out there. And so these boogeymen will come and go. They're necessary to maintain the level of anxiety and fear that is so much a part of American politics since 9/11. And so, yeah, if it's not Khorasan today, it'll be another group tomorrow, the Legion of Doom or what have you. And we'll create these or locate them or relabel old bad guys as necessary and basically repeat as necessary.
And you mentioned James Comey, the too tall director of the FBI, who was crowned, given the 10-year appointment with zero debate. And he has been picking up the talking point that has been embraced by Dianne Feinstein, the Senate Intelligence Chair, and many others. And that is that we have to be deeply afraid not only of Ebola now, but of the threat of returning fighters. And they can't even give us a straight number on how many Americans went to Syria to fight against the Assad government, which we supported, and apparently remain today as part of the IS force. It's been described as a dozen, as 100, as 200, and yet we don't have a single shred of evidence that there is any plotting against the badly named American homeland.
You know, the whole ISIS is going to attack the United States meme is in itself kind of almost a joke. ISIS has existed in one form or another since at least 2007, depending on when you date their split from al-Qaeda. And since that time, it's been seven some years, some people argue even longer, they've never shown any ability to operate outside their home turf. And so the idea that suddenly they're capable of global action is kind of a joke. Americans have been joining jihad for a number of years as well, and some of them have returned home. Most of them seem to find their way to getting killed over there, which is, you know, part of the jihad concept. But so far, nothing's ever happened from them. In the meantime, it's worth pointing out that we have kind of regular mass shootings, school shootings, disgruntled employee shootings, far beyond anything that terrorists have done. I mean, pretty much we've got the two Boston bomber kids, three dead there, and then Major Nidal Hassan, who killed some service people down in Fort Hood, but was not particularly a danger to the homeland writ large. Mm-hmm. In addition, we've recently had one disgruntled employee set fire to the Chicago air traffic control facility and essentially take down most of air traffic over the Midwest and routing through it, but that wasn't terrorism either. And of course, in Oklahoma, an actual bona fide Muslim beheaded someone at work, and that somehow didn't count for terrorism. So I think, again, all this talk of returning American jihadis wreaking havoc across our nation is just fear-mongering. It's the latest thing. In fact, CNN had a headline this afternoon that called Ebola the ISIS of viruses. We're, you know, combining the memes somehow. And this is going to continue. It's been a feature for 13 years since 9/11, and hard to see it going away because it's been so damn successful for the government, allowing them to do everything from spying on our email to bombing countries.
Well, and I agree that this distraction will be used to prevent release of the Senate report on torture. Mm-hmm. And it also has further derailed even the very modest attempts at reining in domestic surveillance by the NSA and other intelligence agencies. All that is pretty well out the window now, as we have to focus on the boogeyman of the moment. Peter, you sent me a draft of an article that has since been published at the American Conservative, and you listed in a David Letterman style, without any jokes, 10 reasons why the new war in Iraq and Syria will fail. And I wanted to touch on a few of these because the you know, the chemistry that we're seeing really doesn't support the idea of a well-oiled coalition. This is a coalition for PR purposes only. And in particular, you talk about Turkey as a nation to watch. Now, the Turks, pardon me, stayed out for a while. They did have nearly 50 hostages that were being held, and those people were released. And now the Turkish parliament has approved involvement militarily, and most importantly, the use of Turkey as a base for launching attacks in Syria and Iraq. Talk a little bit about your sense of how significant that is.
You know, I want to go back to your comment about this being largely a coalition of publicity purposes. That accounts for a very large number of the coalition members, particularly the Westerners, the British, the Australians. You know, they understand they need to play nice with America, and they'll make little contributions, and everyone's happy. But keep in mind, there's coalition members who have their very own agendas, who are, in fact, almost taking advantage of the coalition to kind of push their ideas forward. And in that, I include the Sunni countries, the Saudis, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, whoever, who are very much interested in playing in this game for their own goals, particularly to make sure that the Shias stay where they are and to get a foot in the door there. So there's a lot of different reasons, and that brings us to Turkey. Turkey is really the country that's caught in the middle of all this. The Turks, and it can get a little complicated, but stick with me. The Turks, for a very long time, had opposed Assad and had done so with the encouragement of the United States. Turkey allowed foreign fighters to flow through its country to reinforce what we now call ISIS, because they were fighting Assad. Turkey allowed and still allows oil that ISIS has that they capture, dig up, mm-hmm. To flow out to market through Turkey. One of the problems is that Turkey was kind of caught flat-footed when America switched from wanting to depose Assad to wanting to get rid of ISIS. I think the Turks got the memo late on that one and are still kind of trying to figure out how to disassemble one thing and maybe reassemble another thing. But I think the Turks have a real problem in the idea of the United States arming, empowering, leading, and assisting the Kurds. The Turks have fought a bitter sectarian battle against the Kurds. In the 1980s and 90s, at its peak, over 37,000 people died in fighting between Turks and Kurds, mm-hmm. particularly the Turkish army, against a group of Kurds called the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party. And these groups are still there, and the Turks are very fearful of Kurdish independence movements. Right. Eastern Turkey is very much a Kurdish area, and suddenly in a very powerful Kurdish army crawling up Turkey's eastern border and an empowered Kurdish force on Turkey's southern border, which it shares with Syria, must be scaring the sweat out of the Turks at this point in time. And so the idea that they're supposed to now come in on the side of the Americans, which means the side of the Kurds, and support American empowerment of the Kurds just doesn't make any sense to the Turks. They will be forced to pay lip service to it, but I think at the end of the day, the Turks are much more afraid of the Kurds than they are of anything else. And if you're not sure, take a look at what's happening right now in Kobani. This may be overcome by events by the time listeners get to hear this, but right now the Turks are sitting back watching ISIS beat the crap out of the Kurds in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And they're letting it happen. And they're not intervening because they don't want the Kurds to win, and they're very much afraid of the Syrian Kurds crossing the border and helping their cousins out in Turkey and fomenting some kind of sectarian strife in Turkey. That gives you just a hint of how complicated these relations are and how blunt America's sort of, well, you're on our side or you're against us kind of logic, once again, mm-hmm. is. It's another reason, of course, why all of this will collapse around America's ankles, because it can't work. The Kurds cannot ignore the Turks cannot ignore the Kurds just because America doesn't like ISIS anymore.
Mm-hmm. And Peter, three of your 10 points relate to Iran. Its deep influence on the government in Baghdad, its interest in keeping Assad in power for its own purposes, and that we now are in this very awkward situation where, to the extent that we are taking on the Islamic State fighters, we are nominally aligned with Iran.
And there you have, you know, the ultimate sort of strange bedfellows argument. Though in this case, the Iranians are playing the game very, very well, almost to the opposite of how badly the Americans are playing it. There's going to be two winners out of this whole mess that the United States has kicked off once again in the heart of the Middle East. One will be the Kurds, who will get some form of nation state out of all this. Whether it will be an actual country with a seat at the UN and, you know, sports teams at the Olympics and stuff, or whether it'll be sort of a Taiwan-like wink-wink nudge-nudge construct is not as relevant as the fact that the Kurds are going to come out big winners. Though the champ, the country that is going to emerge from all this with all the goodies and no downside that I can see, is Iran. Iran always wanted a strong Shia government in Baghdad to protect its western borders, and it's got that, and thanks to the United States, it will have that Shia government there for a very, very long time. The Iranians welcome the American Air Force serving as their air cover as they have troops on the ground fighting against the Sunni forces in ISIS. It saves them the trouble of having to fly their own combat missions and allows them to point the finger when inevitably American bombs hit a school or a hospital or a mosque or whatever, that these things will eventually happen. The Iranians are going to come away with clean hands on that. The Iranians are also, I'm sure, chuckling to themselves about how this has improved their bargaining position with the United States vis-a-vis the nuclear issue. It would seem unlikely, though you can never underestimate American diplomatic stupidity, it would seem unlikely that the United States can go to the wall demanding the Iranians abandon their nuclear program when at the same time we're dependent on the Iranians as one big part of our boots on the ground in Iraq. At worst, the Iranians are going to get a series of, well, we'll get to it some other day, stalling on the United States part, where that any nuclear agreements are just basically push forward. The Iranians may even get a little scrap or two out of the deal, but that's hard politically for the United States to yield up. Basically, it is very, very hard to see a downside to what the Iranians are going to get out of this war. I guess the biggest downside I could imagine is they put up a statue of Obama in the middle of Tehran.
Well, and Peter, that leads me to where I want to take this, which is that when we look at the entire picture, the U.S. and President Obama are being played on multiple levels, all right? We are supporting an Iraqi military that is not loyal to even the Shia leadership, much less the interests of the United States. We are, you know, launching raids into Syria with the nominal support of Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, and related parties who have funded the rebel groups, including IS, in Syria for several years now, and who have, as you have articulated well, their own ulterior motives. We can't trust the Turks because their number one issue, as you pointed out, is preventing the Kurds from creating a freestanding, independent country. And so in each of these cases, the U.S., at least as it's played out in the corporate media in this country, has allies who are really not allies. And the idea that we can lead this effort and that it will produce any kind of meaningful result, not necessarily the ones you and I would look for, but just realistically, anything where you could say, okay, this military action achieved this goal. Well, it all will be hollow because we don't have the real support of the people who we pretend are on our side.
Countries, possibly with the exception of the United States, act in their own self-interest. That is one of the canons of diplomacy, one of the first things that you're taught at the State Department, to identify what that country's self-interests are and then see if you can align what America wants with any of those things. But you're taught from the very beginning that the other country's goals are not inherently the same as America's goals, even if and when they cooperate with us. America seems to have missed that chapter in the Diplomacy 101 handbook this time around, and is so desperate to piece together something they can call a coalition for domestic political reasons that they're just ignoring the reality. Every one of these places has their own game going, and occasionally their needs and our needs are going to align. But if you're not aware of that and you're not proceeding with that awareness, then you will get played. It's the old joke. If you don't know who the patsy is at the poker table, it's you.
Yeah.
And that's what America is. We're the patsy at the table, asking, dumb questions and betting all the wrong way while everyone around us smiles and rakes in the chips. It pulls us back, though, to a much more fundamental question, which is, exactly what is the point? What is America trying to achieve by all this? Once upon a time, the go-to for every intervention in the Middle East was democracy, nation building, new countries, evil dictators, yada, yada, yada. Then for a while it was oil. We have to secure the oil. If the Gulf closes, oil's going to go up to $1 trillion a barrel, la, 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 la. Well, that, of course, is largely becoming old news as America moves towards being a net exporter of oil. We'll leave the fracking argument aside. The point is a lot of oil is now coming out of the ground in the United States. And so the need for all this Persian Gulf oil is starting to fade significantly. Well, then we've really kind of settled now on, well, we have to defeat terrorists. And even that, of course, has no touch point with reality, because it's pretty obvious to everyone that works for anyone outside of the mainstream media that every one of these actions by the United States does nothing but create new threats, more terrorists. I mean, it's basic physics, right? Action, reaction, that type of thing. You can't simply expect everyone to sit back while the United States carpet bombs them. Now, I don't think you're going to see, as we talked about earlier, ISIS running through the shopping malls of America, but there are plenty of American targets overseas, and in fact, we import new American targets into the battlefield every day. There are plenty of American soldiers to kill inside of Iraq. There's no reason to fly all the way to New York. There's plenty right in your own neighborhood. So you're left with the question of really, what is the point? And I don't have an answer for you. And I don't know that the president has an answer, or John Boehner, or anyone else. I truly do not know why the United States has reinserted itself into Iraq.
I share your concern there, and I don't think there is an answer. And it really is stunning to see a smart guy like Obama cornered into the need to do something to show people that he did something, when, as we have really pretty well aired out in this conversation, it is a pointless set of exercises that really doesn't have any clear goal. And it will slog on for the foreseeable future, cost us billions more and more lives, American and others. And it's tragic in its dimensions. That is very clear. Peter, I'm going to link to your American Conservative article and also a story you recently wrote for Tom Dispatch. It also appeared at Salon. So listeners can review those as they listen to this conversation. And before we wrap up, I wanted to get an update on the novel that you published earlier this year, The Ghosts of Tom Joad. You recently went back to Buckeye Land. Tell me what the reception there was like.
The book is about what has happened to our society and our economy over the last 40 or 50 years, the dilution of the middle class, the rise of the working poor, what in kind of shorthand we call the 1% versus the 99%. And I've talked about the book in a couple of Midwest cities recently, including in Kentucky and also in Ohio, where the story is actually set. And the reaction has been very positive. People nod their heads. People come up to me afterwards, and every one of them has a story. Oh, that's you could have written that book about my grandfather. You could have written that book about what happened to my family in Hazard, Kentucky. Or you could have written that book about my father losing his job at the Youngstown Steel Mill. Or did you read what's going on in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania? And every single one of these people had a personal story that they could tie to my semi-fictional version of events. And it was very, very moving to me to hear what they had to say and to hear how real the stuff I sort of made up has become to them.
Mm-hmm.
It was also very sad, of course, because these are good folks. They're not perfect people. They're not Springsteenian, sweat of the salt of the earth kind of folks. And they're not the dumb, up-holler Cletuses that sometimes people think. They're people, and they're trying to do the best they can. And I was grateful for the reaction, grateful for the nice things that people said, but also, as I mentioned, very, very moved by their plight and very concerned, really, mm-hmm. about their future and our future as a nation.
Well, I think it's a very important book. I hope that listeners who haven't picked it up yet will find it and read it. It's The Ghosts of Tom Joad. Peter Van Buren, always a pleasure. Thank you for sharing your expertise again with us today.
Thank you, Peter. Anytime.
Another great conversation with Peter Van Buren. As always, I welcome your comments. Drop me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.